And joining us today is Susan Southard. Susan is a journalist, and she is also the artistic director of the Essential Theater in Tempe, Arizona. But she's also the author of the book, Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War. And in this book, she tracks the lives of five teenagers at the time, three men and two women. And she talks about what they went through. And of course, as you all are probably familiar with, a lot of anniversaries in 2015, the end of the Civil War, President Lincoln's assassination, and also the end of World War II, and the bombing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And joining us today, as I mentioned, is Susan Southard. Susan, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, first of all, as I mentioned, because we kind of teased our audience when I said you were the artistic director of the Essential Theater in Arizona, what is that?
We are a professional theater company. We just finished our 25th season, and we work in the field of theater and social change, which can be defined in a lot of different ways, but in our case, it means working with marginalized audiences, people who have little or no access to the arts. So we perform and we do workshops with homeless adults and children and young people and adults who are in prison and adults with developmental disabilities or other similar people who unfortunately, in my opinion, live on the periphery of the mainstream society and therefore have very little access to the arts.
And as far as what you present to them, when you talk about social issues, are most of the plays directed at that so they can learn a little bit about what's going on in the world and at the same time bring attention to their plight?
Well, it's slightly different than that. The art form that we do is called playback theater. It's something that has been around for 40 years and is done internationally in maybe as many as 50 countries. It's where people in the audience tell stories from their lives. And then the ensemble, our ensemble in this case, of actors and musicians, bring that story to artistic life using music, movement, and theater, and as a way to honor the individual's experience and to celebrate the common humanity of everyone in the room. So it's improvised, interactive performance.
And it's all done there in Arizona, or do you all travel?
We travel some, but mostly we're in Arizona.
We are visiting with Susan Southard. Susan is the author of the book Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War. And I mentioned a little bit about Susan and what she does in Arizona, but I was kind of holding back on, you know, everything else, all the accolades she has. So I'm going to go ahead and talk about that right now. She holds an MFA in creative writing from Antioch University in Los Angeles and was a nonfiction fellow at the Norman Mailer Center in Provincetown, Massachusetts. Nagasaki was a finalist for the J. Anthony Lucas Work in Progress Award, and that was sponsored by Harvard University's Nieman Foundation and the Columbia School of Journalism. She currently lives in Tempe, Arizona, as we just mentioned, and she is the founder and artistic director of Essential Theater, which she was just discussing. Now, the book that we're discussing here, Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War, as I mentioned, you take on a generation of Hibakusha. Can you explain what that is?
Yes. Hibakusha is the unique Japanese name given to the people of Hiroshima and Nagasaki who survived the nuclear, not only who survived, those who were killed as well, the nuclear bombings of those two cities. And my book tells the story of Nagasaki from the moment of the bombing, with a little bit of backstory first, to the present day, featuring the lives and the experiences of five survivors, all of whom were teenagers on the morning of the bombing in 1945.
One of the things that's interesting for people who may not be familiar with the Japanese culture or the Japanese culture back then is when you open up the book, you tell us a little bit about these teenagers at the time and what they were going through, the home life. And it was interesting as far as when the war came about and how they were very loyal to their emperor.
Yes, they were. There are a couple of points to make about that, I think. The first is that they knew nothing else. They had no information or connection to the world outside of Japan and the incredible militaristic machine that was driving Japan's aggression throughout East Asia, and, of course, initially on Pearl Harbor. Everyone was very deeply indoctrinated in the message of the militaristic leaders that Japan kind of deserved, and it was possible for Japan to, expand its empire exponentially and be a major world leader, if not the world leader. And questioning anything was so forbidden that if one, even in private, were to question and get reported, that could result in being imprisoned. But these were all children at the time. They were ages, the stories of the people who I cover, those survivors were all aged 13 to 18 and really didn't have any means to critically think about what they were going through.
As you mentioned earlier, these children knew nothing else. This is the way they grew up, and so this is what they thought existed, and that was it. And they, if you wouldn't mind sharing with us about the imperial way and what they were taught.
Yes, they were taught that they had to be completely loyal to the emperor, who was by that time constructed by the government's leaders to be a divine leader of Japan. The emperor was always considered divine in some way, but it became during the years leading up to the war and during the war much more focused and mandated to a person, and messages about loyalty and about supporting the war came down from Tokyo to every prefecture, which is like a state in Japan, and then into every city, and then within the cities into the districts, and from the districts into the neighborhoods. And so there was this very strong structure of maintaining loyalty and discipline to the divine emperor.
We are visiting with Susan Southard. Susan is the author of the book Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War. And as you all know, in 2015, it was the 70th anniversary of the dropping of the bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And there have been some, I guess this is probably the first time that anyone has gone in depth to talk about the survivors of this, except for John, is it Hersey or Hersey?
Hersey.
Hersey, John Hersey's book, huh? Or Hiroshima. And this is something that some people also, when they think of the bombing and the atomic bomb, they think of Hiroshima, and Nagasaki is kind of in the background.
It's so true. Over the years, as the memory of the end of the Pacific War fades, and as Hiroshima has kind of emerged as this symbolic icon of the atomic bombings, Nagasaki is far lesser known. So that's about Nagasaki. And the other thing that's really almost not known at all, John Hersey wrote his book Hiroshima in 1946, which and it's still read as an important book in many high school and college curriculums across the United States. But because it was written so long ago, the stories that Hersey tells are only through the first, 6 or 8 months after the bombing. And survival of nuclear war is a lifetime endeavor, and includes many different layers of challenge, illness, psychological suffering, and endurance and resilience for those who were fortunate enough to have enough endurance and resilience to survive for all these 70 years plus.
And as tragic as that is, before the bombs were dropped, life was very tough for these people, as you mentioned earlier, Susan. And just going in your book, you describe the lives that these children had. And one of them is family life and food. Rationing were 2 cups of rice per people per month. And then from the young lady's standpoint, the fact that males dominated And I think in that book, you bring out the fact that one of the little girls says that her dad always got extra food, even with the rations.
It's true. It's very true. It's a strange reality from our 21st century American perspective. But that was the way of Japanese life at the time. And it's true that people across Japan were starving. The infrastructure of Japan had been destroyed. All of the men of military age were fighting overseas, and so children by 1944, children 14 and over were required to leave school and work for the war effort, and that could mean many different kinds of jobs. Some of them worked in factories. Some of them did other types of jobs within their cities. So all but one of the survivors whose stories I tell in the book already had left school and were working for the war effort because they were 14 or older.
And it's interesting that in the Japanese and the imperial way, the way it was back then, honor was very important, and it's still very important in the Asian culture. But back then also, if you lost a child in the war, it was to be an honor, and the parents couldn't really grieve because they would get in trouble, I guess.
Right. It's a very interesting, subtle point about life. They could grieve privately, but they couldn't grieve publicly. People, when they might meet a neighbor or a friend out on the street or anywhere out in public, they would be congratulated and for their son or father's or brother's or uncle's service to the country. And they couldn't respond with any expression of deep grief publicly. It was quite restricted in that way.
We're visiting with Susan Southard. Susan is the author of the book Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War. And in this book, Susan traces the lives of five teenagers at the time, three men and two women. And she guides us as we're talking a little bit about the history, about before the bomb was dropped and what was going on in Japan. It was very tough. And as Susan has told us about the rules and the government, and this is all they knew, so they didn't think anything was odd. But if you wouldn't mind now kind of taking us and telling us about how you went about tracking and tracing the lives of these five people.
Thank you. It was a long journey. I speak Japanese. I lived in Japan as an international exchange student when I was in high school for a year. And so I learned Japanese pretty well then, with no one in my host family or in my school speaking English. And during that year was my first time to visit the Nagasaki Atomic Bomb Museum on a field trip with the senior class of my school. And it was an amazingly powerful experience to see the remnants, the burned remnants, and the photographs of people ill with radiation and with these massive scars across their whole bodies from the burns, from the searing heat of the nuclear blast. So that's kind of sparked my interest. But the real story began for me in 1986, which is a long time ago, really, when one of the survivors who I've written about in the book, Taniguchi Sumiteru, was in Washington, D.C., where I lived at the time, and was on a speaking tour, and I happened to go and listen to him speak. And afterwards, I introduced myself, and though I don't remember doing this, I must have given him my card, my business card, because I got a call the next day saying that his interpreter was unable to complete the final 2 days of Mr. Taniguchi's stay in Washington, D.C., and could I step in to help?
Wow.
Well, that was the beginning of it, because Mr. Taniguchi had several speaking events and meetings with people in Washington, D.C., which I translated for him, interpreted for him. But in between all of those those events and commitments that he had. There was no one else who spoke Japanese, so we spent many, many hours together talking. His story is so riveting, and I found him to be so compelling that I could never forget that experience. And I traveled to Nagasaki again the next year to see him, and I met some other survivors. And as the years went on after that, I kept thinking, what is it like as they get older? He was 57 when I met him, but he was in his 70s, early 70s, I believe. I'd have to calculate that when I actually started the book. And what was it like for a person whose life was split in half by nuclear war to come to the end of their lives? How did they think about the experience? And what was their experience like? No one has, as you mentioned earlier, has told the story of the lifelong journey of nuclear survival. And so that's what compelled me. And I started the project in 2003, and 12 years later, in 2015, it was finally completed and published.
As far as interviewing the rest of these people, because this gentleman that you mentioned, it was incredible that they, you know, they asked you to step in and help out, because this kind of opened the door for a lot of other opportunities, I guess. And did you meet these other people through this man?
Well, actually, it wasn't through Mr. Taniguchi. When I decided to embark on the book, I made contact with people who, in officials in Nagasaki, who very graciously helped me set up interviews over the next few years with other survivors who I hadn't met until I went to interview them. And over the course of the first 8 years of the project, I traveled to Nagasaki 5 times to interview and do follow-up interviews with each of the 5 survivors, and got to know them fairly well. It was a great privilege and an honor to be allowed into their more personal aspects of nuclear survival.
We're visiting with Susan Southard. Susan is the author of the book Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War. And in this book, Susan traces the lives of 5 teenagers at the time and what they experienced when the bomb was dropped. And when you write in your book and you're telling pretty much how everybody started their day, what went on, and then when you get to the part that you're describing what actually happened, when you were sitting at your computer or writing or taking notes, what went through your mind as far as describing this? Because it's very tastefully done, but it's also very gripping, and wondering, my gosh, it must have been horrible.
Right. And frankly, my words really don't suffice. You know, it's really unimaginable what happened on the ground beneath the mushroom cloud. But for me, it's odd, because as the writer of that section, during the actual writing of it, it was so complicated to figure out how to take hundreds of people's experiences and many sources of the scientific and medical and historical documents about the bombing of Nagasaki and the moment of the explosion and the next, you know, that even just that day. There were so many documents and so many perspectives, and how to write it in a way that would make sense and that would tell, hopefully, the power of the experience. It was such a huge challenge technically that at the time that overpowered my own sense of grief and shock and intensity. But when I did all the research for that, it was sometimes very overwhelming. It's just sometimes just incredibly overwhelming. But when I was actually writing it, my job was to try to figure out how to make it clear and how to make it truthful. So that even just that that chapter, which is chapter 2 in the book, you know, probably took about 6 months to write.
And from the perspective of the pilots of the airplanes, they also the fact that, you know, they weren't really aware of what was there. It was a big secret. And in fact, President Truman didn't find out until months right before it was the decision was made. And as your book states and as others have stated in the reviews, your book is not about whether this was right or wrong, but you're telling us what impact this had on these five people who are still alive. And the gentleman that you met in Washington, I mean, the way you described that he was on his stomach for 4 years because of his back.
It's true. He was, as I said earlier, 16 at the time, and his job, his war support job, was to be a postal delivery boy. Excuse me. So he was riding his bicycle, through the kind of northwestern section of the city, and he was facing away from the blast when the blast occurred, and it blew him off his bicycle, and his bicycle was mangled and tangled like taffy, he described, because of the heat. And he didn't even realize until a little bit later, because he was in so much shock, that the heat, he was over a mile away, but even there, the heat of the bomb was so high that he was wearing his a wool post office uniform, and it disintegrated the uniform, the shirt beneath it, and burned the skin off his entire back and part of his body, you know, part of his arm as well. And all of the hospitals in Japan in Nagasaki were damaged or destroyed. So there was very few medical supplies. Doctors started pouring in from other parts of the region soon after, but he didn't really get to a true hospital until November of 1945, 3 months later. And then he stayed in that hospital until March of 1949, when he was finally, and he lay on his stomach, as you said, for all of those years, in agonizing pain, begging the nurses to let him die. And he developed such, because he couldn't ever be positioned anywhere except on his stomach, he developed very deep bed sores that even to this day have left really penetrating deep holes in his chest. It's really just astonishing that he survived and was able to rebuild his life, although he has been in constant pain throughout his life and has endured, I think it may be as many as 13 or 15 surgeries over the last 70 years.
We're visiting with Susan Southard. Susan is the author of the book Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War, and Susan was just describing some of the injuries and surgeries that, how do you pronounce his name again? I'm sorry. Mr. Taniguchi went through, and Mr. Taniguchi is one of the gentlemen that helped Susan and introduced her, I guess, because she was speaking in Washington, and then she filled in at the last moment, and it was a stroke of luck, but this book took 12 years to write, a lot of research, a lot of going on, and what these people, what Mr. Taniguchi experienced, and now in his 80s, when he talked to you, did he have any, people might wonder, ill feelings or anything about what happened?
Does he have any, I'm sorry?
Ill feelings?
Yes, he does. And really the book also covers the entire city. You know, these five stories are woven throughout the narrative in the context of what was happening throughout the city over 70 years. And the survivors that I met do not hold any anger toward Americans, and they certainly are know very well the atrocities that Japan committed, and the bombing of Pearl Harbor, that Japan's aggression that initiated the war. But they are passionate about the elimination of nuclear weapons across the world. For these five that I met, and for a small number, that's not, not everyone is, not every survivor by any stretch is an activist, an anti-nuclear activist. Many just have tried to live their lives and lead as peaceful a life as possible in the context of post-nuclear survival, which is a big challenge. But Mr. Taniguchi does have, of the five, I think he has the greatest degree of kind of a quiet underlying anger. He feels that that he was a part of a U.S. military experiment and was a guinea pig so that the United States could understand what would happen when the bomb was dropped on Nagasaki, which was a different kind of bomb than that the one that was dropped on Hiroshima. And so he has a pretty strong, it's not very detectable, except that I spent so much time with him over so many years, and anger at...
You can read it.
Mm-hmm.
We just talked to 2015 with the 70th anniversary, and it's not something to celebrate, of course, but since the bomb was dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and ironic or not, it was also the year when the United States, President Obama, negotiated a nuclear deal with Iran, and so people are wondering, will this happen again? And so if people are wanting to know a little bit about your book, the research, and in the back, you notate almost everything, like the first 60 seconds, what happened a day after, what happened 6 months later, so people can look into that. So a lot of research went into this. But if they want to go and find out more about you and this writings and Mr. Taniguchi, do you have a Facebook page or a website they can go to, Susan?
I have both. Okay. My website is my name, www.susansouthard.com. And I have a Facebook page under my name as well. I think it's Susan Southard Author, to differentiate it from my personal Facebook page. And there you can follow updates on the book, reviews, appearances. This week, leading up to the – this is not
That's
being
okay.
aired right now. But in the week leading up to the book release, I introduced each of the five survivors with photographs from when they were children and photographs as older adults and a little snippet of their stories. There's also, just so you know, a very cool thing available. It's called an enhanced ebook, and it is it contains all the photographs, the 55 photographs that are in the print book, but it also includes many more photographs and almost 35 minutes of historic video, of historic video and short clips of the survivors telling me their stories, woven into the manuscript. And it's really exciting because it brings it to life in at a whole new level, I think.
Well, thank you for sharing that, Susan. And we've been visiting with Susan Southard. Susan is the author of the book Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War. Susan, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Norma Martinez. Our producer is Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.